Q, Charlotte Cates, Sami Doon, Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, and Mona Kandil at the top of the hour from Occupied Ramallah. With that, we come to end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikova Tahway. It's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's leader says countries can turn sanctions into a tool of empowerment by tapping into their national capacities. Iran says the International Atomic Energy Agency's latest report on its uranium stockpile is only one-sided. Also, oil prices jump after European Union leaders reach an agreement to ban 90% of Russian crude by the end of the year. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says world powers are weaponizing sanctions against other countries, but such bans can be crippled by focusing on domestic powers and capacities. In a meeting with the visiting Tajik president, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said that Iran has made good progress in various fields, not just despite, but also because of Western coercive measures. The leader said that Tehran and Dushanbe can expand their ties much further than the current level, and the relations must undergo fundamental transformation. Elsewhere, Ayatollah Khamenei called for the formation of an exclusive, inclusive-led government in Afghanistan, stressing that Iran and Tajikistan are both concerned about the spread of terrorism and Takfiri groups in the region. For his part, Imam Ali Rahman also called for the improvement of Iran-Tajikistan ties. He said that his country seeks peace and stability in Afghanistan, ruled by a government with the participation of all ethnicities. University professor Fuad Izadi says the leader is sending a message of resilience to the U.S. by downplaying the impact of sanctions amid talks to revive the 2015 deal.
Well, I think the section of Ayatollah Khamenei's speech on sanctions had two purposes. One, it's customary for world leaders, when they meet, they share experiences, both positive experiences, negative experiences. So this is an achievement of Iran to be able to grow and become a leader in many scientific fields at the same time. that the country has been under sanctions. So that's the number one reason. It's ordinary thing to do. I think the second reason Ayatollah Khamenei talked about sanctions is with regard to what's going on with JCPOA. As you know, the United States government, the Biden administration, is basically following the Trump lead when it comes to Iran. Biden is basically implementing Trump's policies, and the negotiations are not going fast anywhere. So the message, I think, the second reason this issue is raised is to give this idea to the other side that Iran can live with sanctions, and Iran has been able to overcome difficulties. And the basic message is that even if the United States wants to continue that policy of sanctioning Iran, it may actually have some benefits in the long run for the country.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has released footage showing the seizure of two Greek tankers in the Persian Gulf over maritime violations. The video shows IRGC's Hellebore special forces boarding and taking control of the Greek ships. The vessels were impounded on Friday. Shipping sources said one tanker was carrying an oil cargo bound for the U.S., while the other was heading for Greece. The incident came weeks after Greece impounded an Iranian-flagged oil tanker and delivered its cargo to the U.S. The Iranian Foreign Ministry summoned the Swiss and Greek envoys over the issue. Switzerland represents U.S. interests in Iran. The ministry slammed the U.S. violation of international law and maritime conventions governing free navigation and trade. It also demanded the immediate release of the seized ship and its cargo. Iran criticizes the UN Atomic Agency's latest report on its nuclear activities, warning of the consequences of such one-sided reports. Iran's envoy to the Vienna-based international organizations, Mohammad Reza Ghaibi, says the International Atomic Energy Agency's latest report on the country's uranium stockpile fails to reflect Tehran's extensive cooperation with the body. In its report, the IAEA has estimated that Iran's stockpile of enriched uranium has increased to more than 18 times the limit laid down in the 2015 nuclear deal. It also claims that Iran is continuing the enrichment to levels higher than the authorized limit. But Ghaibi says the report relies only on the agency's predetermined assumptions, and that the unconstructive approach could harm cooperation between the two sides. Oil prices are seeing a rise over the European Union's decision to cut two-thirds of Russia's oil imports into the bloc. In early deals, Brent crude reached a two-month high of $122, while U.S. West Texas Intermediate reached $118 per barrel. EU leaders have agreed to ban oil imports from Russia by as much as 90% by the end of this year. The embargo affects Russian oil imports via sea, but pipeline deliveries will be exempted. The continued pipeline purchases is meant to allow Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic more time to trim Russian supplies. The embargo is part of the sixth package of EU sanctions on Moscow since the beginning of the Ukraine war. Official data shows that Germany's inflation has set a fresh record as the war in Ukraine pushes already high energy and food prices up even further. The preliminary data from Federal Statistics Agency, Des Statis, shows the country's annual inflation reached 7.9% in May. It marks the highest since German reunification in 1990. It is also the highest reading since 1973, when mineral oil prices increased following the oil crisis there. The Statistics Office attributes the current rise in inflation to energy prices. It says the war in Ukraine pushed energy prices to over 38% in May, year on year. Food prices also increased by more than 11%. The office also blames supply chain problems due to the coronavirus pandemic as another factor pushing up inflation. The head of the Iranian Islamic Seminaries, Ayatollah Ali Reza Arafi, is in Rome for an official visit. During his trip to Italy, the prominent Iranian cleric met with Pope Francis and members of the Shia community. Max Chivali has more from Rome.
On Monday, head of the Iranian Islamic Seminaries, Ayatollah Ali Reza Arafi, held meetings with the head of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, and high-ranking prelates at the Vatican. The prominent Iranian cleric presented the pontiff with refined artifacts from his hometown of Maybod in Yazd province and the holy city of Qom. After that, the two religious personalities held private talks. Iran and the Vatican established full diplomatic ties in 1954, and the bond has remained uninterrupted ever since. Not many reflect on the fact that Iran and the Vatican both represent spiritual traditions that have much more in common than might initially come to mind. Ayatollah Arafi's visit to the Holy See coincided with the commemorations of the 33rd anniversary of the demise of Imam Ruhollah Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran. On Sunday evening, Arafi paid a visit to the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center, where he met with members of Rome's Shia community. Here, the cleric attended a commemoration of the late leader of Iran's 1979 revolution.
All thinkers who came before Imam Khomeini had predicted an end for the age of spirituality, and faithful from all religions, including the Muslims, had lost hope in the spiritual ways of living. Imam Khomeini took Islam and all religions to a more elevated spirituality, restoring their hope.
The commemoration held at the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center was also attended by Iran's diplomats and representatives of Rome's Palestinian community. There was much anticipation at the center for Ayatollah Arafi's visit.
Ayatollah Arafi's visit to Italy and to our center is very meaningful. We are honored to have him with us, and this spurs us to further study the thinking of Imam Khomeini and to ask ourselves what the role of the Shias is in the community.
In November 2020, Ayatollah Arafi sent a letter to the Holy See in which he expressed his concerns regarding the insults made against the Prophet Muhammad and the hatred expressed by some magazines, journalists, and political figures in different societies. In response to this letter, 3 months later, Pope Francis replied to the Iranian cleric, saying he is concerned for those affected by aggression and insults of religious figures, symbols, and sentiments. Max Civili, Rome.
Damascus slams Ankara's plan to establish a safe zone in northern Syria as an act of aggression and an extension of Turkey's ethnic cleansing policy in that area. Syria says the measures taken by Turkey over the past few days have caused civilian casualties and have done massive damage to public and private property, including critical infrastructure. Syria describes Turkey's offensive as a shameful act of aggression that has displaced dozens of families from their homes and villages. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said last week that his country was planning to establish a so-called safe zone along 30 kilometers of its border with Syria. Turkey has deployed forces in Syria in violation of the Arab country's sovereignty. People in Gaza have protested to drum up support for thousands of Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails, especially administrative detainees. Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza, who say that they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes. Rashab Shannon has more.
Families of prisoners and their advocates staged a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in the blockaded Gaza Strip. Their action was in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and detention centers, including more than 500 administrative detainees. Palestinian administrative detainees have been boycotting Israeli regime courts for more than 5 months to protest their administrative detention. Administrative detention is incarceration without trial or charge and has no time limit.
Administrative detainees are subjected to extreme suffering inside Israeli jails. They've been boycotting Israeli courts for more than 150 days to protest the detention without charge. Administrative detention is a racist policy and only causes pain and suffering to Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners suffer from inhumane treatment inside Israeli jails and are being denied basic rights. Since the beginning of this year, Israeli regime forces have arrested some 3,000 Palestinians, including children and women.
Administrative detention is a systematic policy by the Israeli regime to hold Palestinian prisoners behind bars without trial for a very long time. Administrative detention can be renewed indefinitely, and it inflicts psychological pressure on the prisoners. We have all suffered from administrative detention inside Israeli jails.
During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Ministry of Detainees Affairs slammed the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention.
We call on all international human rights organizations to come out of their silence and exert pressure on the Israeli regime to stop the inhumane administrative detention policy. Palestinian prisoners are freedom fighters and must be treated according to international laws and norms. The Israeli regime is violating conventions regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Rights activists say Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails will continue to suffer as long as the world keeps turning a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
According to Palestinian prisoners' advocacy groups, the Israeli regime has arrested around 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Most of these detainees have been held with no charge or trial. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The United Nations has warned that in Afghanistan, 1.1 million children under the age of 5 will likely face the most severe form of malnutrition this year as increasing numbers of hungry children flow into hospital wards. Rahmatullah Baghman has more from Kabul.
The UN bodies warn that factors connected to malnutrition in Afghanistan are going up every month. Millions are struggling with poverty and hunger, and thousands of others are going unemployed. Rising prices are adding to the difficulties of families to provide food.
All these 200 people are unemployed, including me. We have to pay for our houses' rents, treatment and medications, and provide food for our families. I have a family of 10. We can't afford flour, oil or rice due to soaring prices. Most of us can't even have a single meal per day. We should have jobs or receive relief funds.
With the given situation, UNICEF warns that 1.1 million Afghan children are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition this year. Officials at the Indira Gandhi Children's Hospital said that the number of malnourished children in Afghanistan is rapidly increasing, and urgent action is needed to avert the catastrophe.
The increasing number of children at risk of malnutrition is published, which is more than 1 million. What should be done? I urge the UN and international bodies to help Afghans avert this disaster. I hope they consider us as a member of the international community and give us our rights. In particular, we need them to free our frozen funds and separate the health sector from politics.
Due to poverty, most Afghan mothers do not have proper nutrition during pregnancy. Neither can afford enough after birth.
I used to give my child some bread and tea. I was unable to breastfeed her because we couldn't afford food for ourselves. We are coming from poor families. Her father is left jobless at home. My child was constantly losing weight and cried a lot. I knew it was all because of hunger, so I brought her here.
After the Taliban seized power in August 2021, the U.S. and its allies froze about $9 billion in Afghan assets and cut off international funding. This move has partly crippled a system that was already dependent on aid. Malnutrition is a threat to children across Afghanistan. This as the country is suffering from the shortage of medicines, with hospitals being overwhelmed by hungry babies and mothers. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O patron of beneficence.
In Britain, a 52-page analysis by an unnamed historian concludes the origins of the deep-rooted racism of the Windrush scandal lie in the fact that during the period 1950 to 1981, every single piece of immigration or citizenship legislation was designed at least in part to reduce the number of people with black or brown skin who were permitted to live and work in the United Kingdom. We now present you an article written by Amelia Gentleman. The piece is titled, Report says Windrush scandal caused by 30 years of racist immigration laws. According to a leaked government report, the origins of the Windrush scandal lay in 30 years of racist immigration legislation designed to reduce the UK's non-white population. The stark conclusion was set out in a Home Office Commission paper that officials have repeatedly tried to suppress over the past year. The 52-page analysis by an unnamed historian, which has been seen by The Guardian, describes how the British Empire depended on racist ideology in order to function, and sets out how this affected the laws passed in the post-war period. It concludes that the origins of the deep-rooted racism of the Windrush scandal lie in the fact that during the period 1950 to 1981, every single piece of immigration or citizenship legislation was designed, at least in part, to reduce the number of people with black or brown skin who were permitted to live and work in the United Kingdom. It finds that the scandal was caused by a failure to recognise that changes to British immigration law over the past 70 years had a more negative impact on black people than on other racial and ethnic groups. The report states, as a result, the experiences of Britain's black communities, of the Home Office, of the law, and of life in the United Kingdom have been fundamentally different from those of white communities. The report adds, major immigration legislation in 1962, 1968, and 1971 was designed to reduce the proportion of people living in the United Kingdom who did not have white skin. It was not clear why UK officials were reluctant to release the document. Diane Abbott MP, who attempted without success to have the paper released through the Home Affairs Select Committee, said the Home Office appeared to be unwilling to acknowledge the racism that has disfigured British immigration policy for decades. The report was commissioned by the Home Office as part of a commitment to educating civil servants about the causes of the Windrush scandal, which saw thousands of people wrongly classified as illegal immigrants by the department. After the scandal, ministers agreed to teach all 35,000 Home Office employees about Britain's colonial history and the history of black Britons. The report named The Historical Roots of the Windrush Scandal focuses on the immigration legislation of the 20th century rather than on more recent events, such as the effects of the hostile environment policies introduced by Theresa May when she was Home Secretary. The unnamed Home Office historian writes, "The British Empire depended on racist ideology in order to function, which in turn produced legislation aimed at keeping racial and ethnic groups apart. From the beginning, concern about Commonwealth immigration was about skin colour." The report states, in the 1950s, British officials shared a basic assumption that coloured immigrants, as they were referred to, were not good for British society. The document summarises decades of dysfunctional relationships between Britain's institutions and black and minority ethnic groups, and concludes, "The politics of Britain's borders, which have been administered for more than a century by the Home Office, are now inextricably connected with race and with Britain's colonial history." Wendy Williams, the independent inspector advising the Home Office on what changes to make after the Windrush scandal, said in March that she was disappointed the report had not been published a year after officials had signed off on it. "It has been made available to staff internally, but requests for it to be made public have been repeatedly rejected. A Freedom of Information request about the document was refused. Acknowledging that the subject was a matter of legitimate public interest and that openness and transparency were important, the request was nevertheless rejected on the grounds that the Home Office's response to the Windrush scandal included sensitive issues involving the development of policies. Publication of the document could inhibit discussions and the ability of ministers to take free and frank advice. Immigration historians said it was peculiar to suppress a work of history that was funded by the taxpayer. There was speculation over whether the report was withheld internally for a year because its conclusions were at odds with the British government's narrative on race. Last year, Tony Sewell's Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities report on race said there was no evidence to suggest that Britain was an institutionally racist place. Recently, the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, told Parliament, "For centuries, our United Kingdom has had a proud history of welcoming people from overseas." Simon Woolley, the former Chief Executive Officer of Operation Black Vote and Chair of the No. 10 Race Disparity Unit, July 2020, said the refusal to make the report public was shameful. Simon Woolley said, "The government is hell-bent in its denial of the systemic nature of racial inequality, and in this climate, historical facts have become uncomfortable truths that need to be hidden." The report also cites a letter from the Prime Minister to the Federation of the West Indies, Sir Grantley Adams, to the Conservative Prime Minister Harold Macmillan. Sir Grantley Adams protested that Britain has begun to take steps which are no different in kind to the basis on which the system of apartheid in South Africa is based, by introducing the 1962 Commonwealth Immigrants Act. Juanita Cox, a research fellow with the Institute of Commonwealth Studies working on a Windrush scandal research project, said if they admitted the Home Office's legislation pre-1981 was institutionally racist, current legislation might also come under scrutiny and be found to be even worse. Britain's immigration system is at complete odds with the proud image it portrays of welcoming immigrants. Immigration barrister Grace Brown, who has acted for a number of Windrush victims, said the fallout from the legislation was still being felt. She said, "There's no justifiable reason why the continuing and long-lasting effect on individuals of historic discriminatory legislation and policy shouldn't be addressed and corrected today." A Home Office spokesperson said the department would not name the historian who wrote the history, claiming that the Home Office was making progress towards becoming a more compassionate and open organisation.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello and welcome to the latest installment of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. I'm David Miller. This week, we have a special edition of the show, which will examine a British Zionist group which has been harassing and intimidating pro-Palestine activists. Its latest salvo of attacks has been on staff in higher education. We will concentrate today on the case of Shahad Abu Salama, the Palestinian academic suspended and then reinstated at Sheffield Hallam University, whose inspiring fight back against intimidation tactics has shown that Zionists will not always have things their own way. In this special edition of the programme, we'll be joined by Shahad Abu Salama herself to get the inside story of how she won her case. But first, Bianca Rahimi gets us started with this special report on the campaign against anti-Semitism.
This is the story of a secretive organization which conceals the identity of key figures and seems to use anti-racism as a smokescreen to achieve the foreign policy objectives of the Israeli regime in the UK. The campaign against anti-Semitism was founded in London to divert attention from Israel's massacre of over 2,000 Palestinians in Gaza. The first action was to organize a demonstration against and boycott of the Tricycle Theater in Kilburn, which wanted to return a small donation from the Israeli embassy for a film festival, the shortfall being made up by the theatre itself. The CAA falsely claimed the theatre had banned the event. The CAA has been funded by Netan, an organisation chaired by Tony Felsen, a strong supporter and donor to the Friends of the Israel Defence Forces. It is also funded by the Jewish National Fund UK, an organisation described by historian Ilan Pape as a colonialist agency of ethnic cleansing which builds settlements in occupied Palestine. Accounts for the JNF UK show that it provides financial backing to recruitment drives for the Israeli Defence Forces and also to Ian Pratt, a group which enlists North Americans into the Army of Occupation. The JNF is currently being investigated by the Charity Commission after its head, Samuel Hayek, made Islamophobic comments using far-right talking points. The JNF UK honorary patrons include the Prime Minister and President of the Israeli regime, as well as Tony Blair and previously former British Prime Minister David Cameron. The chief executive of the campaign against anti-Semitism is Gideon Falter, who simultaneously serves as the vice chair of the JNF UK. CAA also obtained a very unusual dispensation from Companies House and the Charity Commission to keep its directors secret, even after a challenge under Freedom of Information legislation. We can reveal that one of these, listed as unnamed on the CAA website, is actually Daniel Allington, a lecturer for King's College London. Allington's work is funded by the Alfred Landecker Foundation, run by a pro-Israel lobbyist, Andreas Eberhardt. Allington also does work for the CAA as an academic, without any public disclosure that he is a director, a clear conflict of interest. The CAA website used to tout its honorary patrons, which included Colonel Richard Kemp, a close friend of Benjamin Netanyahu, who was embedded with the Israeli military in Gaza as it sniped Palestinians on the Great March of Return in 2018. Also, there was Mark Lewis of UK Lawyers for Israel, a lawfare lobby group which works closely with the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Despite these honorary patrons proudly associating with CAA, it suddenly made the page on its website unavailable in 2019. Are these individuals no longer patrons? Why the secrecy? The CAA targets pro-Palestine actors with false accusations of anti-Semitism. Before he joined CAA, its director, Gideon Falter, was found to have given a false account of an incident in which a diplomat had denounced Israel. Its reports and research are widely criticized by Jewish groups as flawed and irresponsible. The CAA played a key role in smearing the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn. It submitted a huge dossier to the Equalities and Human Rights Commission, including many false and exaggerated accusations of anti-Semitism. The CAA is also pushing the war on academia to silence criticism of Zionism. When racism comes in the guise of anti-racism, the question is, how can we resist?
To discuss the campaign against anti-Semitism and the forces behind it, we're joined today by a special guest, Shahad Abu Salama, who's a Palestinian writer, activist and artist who has twice been made a refugee by the Zionist Project. She's an associate lecturer at Sheffield Hallam University, and she's recently completed a PhD on the historical representation of Palestinian refugees in documentary cinema. As Shahad has publicly stated, she was defamed and harassed by Zionist publications and was then suspended from her job. However, after a short but intense campaign, she was reinstated to her position on an enhanced contract. Shahad, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, David, and solidarity with you.
I wanted to ask you, first of all, you must be very relieved at this turn of events. It's been fantastic that you've been reinstated. How do you feel?
Of course, it's a win for Palestine. I see it. And we managed, with the collective action and the people who spoke up in support of me, to turn the tide and expose the malicious accusations that were trying to deflect from Israeli crimes that I witnessed and lived through. So it is a great welcome step from the university. However, the bullying and the trolls and the Zionist media defamation has been nonstop.
Sure. You've brought with you a very interesting book. I think you would like to tell us a bit about how this book relates to some of your back history and how that relates then to the attacks that there have been on you.
Yeah, so I'm carrying Felicia Langer's book with my own eyes. Felicia Langer is an Israeli-German lawyer who have defended Palestinian political prisoners since 1967. And she became the lawyer of my father in 1972, which she met him as a 19-year-old, and she recorded his story. My father, this wasn't the first time that he was in prison. He was first in prison when he was 14 or 15 years old. And of course, needless to say that this is a stark violation of international law. Children should be protected, they should be at school, they should be safe in their homes, and not subject to such persecution. So the second time that he was arrested, when he was 19, and was defended by Felicia Langer, he pled not guilty, and he didn't do anything except being Palestinian, angry at the realities of the occupation that meant they could have their houses raided in the middle of the night. He speaks here about wait a minute, I want to read this quote as came from my dad. "I saw children getting killed in the streets of the camp," he says. "Shot by the frontier police. They come to the refugee camp with clubs, beat everybody, go into the houses without knocking on the door. There are women inside. They mix flour into the oil during the searches. Yes, maliciously, without a reason." And then he says further about the torture that he received in the investigation that lasted nearly 3 months. And he lost, as a result of that torture, he lost his sense of hearing, 19 years old. And he said that this even included psychological torture. He said, "Then they threatened me, unless I talked, I would be punished to Amman, where I would be killed." And there are a lot more stories here, but this woman has been an example that I grew up with, you know? Mm-hmm. She is one of the most fearless, anti-Zionist voices that spoke and acted on the side of the Palestinians, because she saw the injustice and she renounced her citizenship in 1991, yeah, the year I was born, and went to Germany, a luxury that she can do, mm-hmm, of course. She left Germany believing that she could not serve justice to the Palestinians under that Israeli apartheid.
And now we come back to today, where organizations like the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, yeah, have targeted you. Many others have targeted you. You referred to trolls and media. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about the kind of effects of that targeting and what kind of groups there are arrayed against you?
So it started actually with Jewish News. I learned from the Zionist press, Jewish News in particular, that my university was investigating me. And that was Christmas Eve. And sadly, the same day, I was mourning the loss of Archbishop Desmond Tutu. And I was mourning, and in the same time, I received this disturbing article that says my university is investigating me, and as a staff member and a PhD student at the university, I should be the first to be approached, not the Zionist media. And I wasn't told. I was left in the dark all this time, preparing for my new position as an associate lecturer teaching post-colonial media culture. And I went to the first lecture that was on 17th of January. And I knew that there was, you know, by then there were the Jewish News article and then the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism that skipped over my right to reply completely and just defamed me without paying any consideration to my lived experience or my response to their previous defamations that they raised against me, because this is not the first time that I'm being silenced and demonized. And of course, for the Palestinians, like, we see this as a part of a consistent pattern that predicates on our demonization and the manipulation of our own reality and histories for the justification and the legitimacy of the Israeli state.
Yeah. So we've got another report now, which tells us a little bit more about the background to your case, and we'll come back to talk about more about your experiences after that.
Thank you so much.
A victory for Palestine. Those were the words of Palestinian academic Shahad Abu Salam after news broke that her British university dropped an investigation against her. Shahad Abu Salama, an activist from Gaza, was appointed as an associate lecturer at Sheffield's Hallam University last month, but was suspended from teaching amidst the investigation. She was accused of sharing anti-Semitic views over her past criticism of Israel and the controversial IHRA definition on anti-Semitism.
The Palestinians have a right to resist their occupier by any means necessary. And this is a right that is entrenched in international law. And no one can take that right from us.
Despite the university's U-turn, an apology remains elusive, despite the immense distress caused.
After a lifelong of struggle, I just want to say that I'm standing here with all of these people. They're all from all sorts of backgrounds, and they're all standing proudly, co-resisting Israeli apartheid with me, and demanding that freedom, justice, and equality is served to the Palestinians. This is long overdue.
University authorities have not yet specified the group or individuals who filed the complaints which led to the suspension. However, Abu Salama is a high-profile rights campaigner and a vocal critic of the definition of Zionism, leading many to suspect pro-Israel groups are trying to whip up a, quote, witch hunt against her. Abu Salama was supported by her professional body, the Universities and Colleges Union, which passed an emergency motion in her defense. They said her public campaigning against Israel falls entirely within the boundaries of acceptable political commentary. This isn't the first survival battle Abu Salama has faced. She and her family are refugees, ethnically cleansed from their home in what is now Israel by Zionist militias in 1948. Like all other Palestinian refugees, they are barred by Israel from returning to their original homes. Amina Taylor for Palestine Declassified.
Shahad, what did you make of that? Can you bring us up to date with your case?
Thank you for the report. It's a great report and definitely put things in context. At the minute, we're still carrying on, you know, like the anger that the victory has created is still posing pressure on me, but also on my university. My father, who's a freedom fighter, is being accused of being a convicted terrorist, and I'm basically a daughter of a convicted terrorist. And of course, that is an ideological condemnation of a legitimate right to resist. And this is the right that is guaranteed by international law. the right of the occupied people to resist their occupier until liberation. And this is what we're doing. We're trying to reclaim our humanity.
And yet, on campus, there are organizations who are fighting for the rights of the occupier.
Exactly.
The UK Lawyers for Israel, for example, they have people on campus at Sheffield. The Union of Jewish Students there, they have a JSOC on campus there, headed by the daughter of a prominent pro-Israel sociologist. Can you tell us about how that manifests itself, the active involvement, not just of off-campus groups, but on-campus groups?
It is horrendous, really. When I saw the latest report by the Jewish Chronicle that uses Jewish in order to conflate between Zionism and Judaism and quell criticisms of Israel. Yeah. They have made their whole story around me being a terrorist and a daughter of a terrorist, and then how that makes Jews unsafe based on one single statement from the president of JSOC at the University of Sheffield. So imagine such generic, false statement made against a whole university just because they did the right thing. Because they did the right thing. I was being silenced, and the university knows that they were unfair to me. And what happened in terms of suspension and the university communicating with the Zionist press and feeding into their lies before even approaching me, that was very harmful. And that added fuel to fire. And we cannot accept such scaremongering statement that contribute to racial hatred and ethno-religious divisions on campus. We cannot accept that.
So what we find, I think, in your case and in many other cases, in my own case at Bristol, in cases in Warwick and in Glasgow, is the university effectively collaborating with the bullies and the people who are trying to intimidate pro-Palestine activists. Can you say, just in closing, what you think is the way forward for resisting this kind of bullying?
A lot should be done. And I think the production of knowledge in itself is resistance. And this counter-narrative that comes out with programs like this, Palestine Declassified, that that comes with stories such as mine, the Palestinian story, that many Palestinians would be able to identify with. We have to resist in whatever we can, with whatever tool we have, because every morning we know Palestinians are waking up to more crimes of ethnic cleansing, of dispossession. The siege is suffocating a whole population in Gaza that is mass incarcerated in the world's largest open-air prison while frequently bombarded. Let's not forget, just last May, 2,070 people were killed. F-16 bombs fell 10 meters away from my house while my family were inside. Can you believe the terror that they lived? And these are serious struggles. These are serious grievances that Israel cannot defend. And that's why they're using the card, abusing the card of anti-Semitism. That is a real issue. And bypassing it and twisting it in order to avoid accountability. And we have to be the pressure that brings Israeli apartheid to justice. We have to be that change. And we are.
But that change, it also needs to push back against those other forces that are involved, the media you've talked about. Can you tell us about the kind of impact that the media and then the trolls have on ordinary activists on the ground and who are doing work in this area?
I mean, of course, it has a chilling effect. And the IHRA definition has been widely criticized by even the person who drafted it. And he said that it wasn't fit for purpose, and it was only going to feed into racial hatred and division, and probably even anti-Semitism. And this is serious. And there were people who have been saying over and over again that Zionism is a form of anti-Semitism, and they are the ones who keep on emphasizing that they are speaking in the name of the world Jewry, when they are far from that. There are more and more Jews around the world that are speaking up against it and saying, no, this is not in my name. No religion would endorse crimes such as this that are being committed in Palestine in daylight, every day. And we are speaking up against it, and we're not going to let their fear-mongering get under our skin. We have a just cause, and we have to resist these forces wherever they are until they are isolated, the same way South African apartheid was isolated and the people who were part of it were isolated.
So we have to talk about the end of Zionism as an ideology, an ideology which is by its nature racist. And one of the first steps surely has to be resisting the IHRA definition, but that's only the first step, surely.
I mean, like the IHRA, before there was the prevent strategy that also affected us seriously, and before that there were lots of unspoken rules that immediately took the side of the oppressor against the oppressed. I mean, like, as a Palestinian, you see that all the time. I've lived through, 22 days of constant bombing against the Gaza Strip, 2008, 2009. I was only 17, attending mid-school exams and studying on candlelight of the scarcity of electricity and in constant fear over my life and my loved ones' lives. And these, under those times, I've noticed how international media is part of the problem.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We were feeling isolated, being killed in our masses, and displaced over again. My father's school that was turned into a makeshift shelter was bombed with white phosphorus, internationally banned weapons. All these crimes have to be addressed, and they have to be brought...
Yes, thank you very much. Sorry, that's all we've got time for. Shad, thank you very much for your inspiring words. Thanks for joining us, everyone, and we'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. I've been David Miller. Bye for now.
in the limelight.
And U.S. Representative Adam Kinzinger called out his fellow Republicans on Sunday, 29th of May, for being scared to death to talk about gun control following the deadly mass shooting at a Texas elementary school earlier this week. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Andrew Stanton. The piece is titled, Adam Kinzinger Says Fellow Republicans Scared to Talk About Gun Issue. And the U.S. Representative Adam Kinzinger called out his fellow Republicans on Sunday for being scared to death to talk about gun control following the deadly mass shooting at a Texas elementary school earlier this week. Calls for gun control have been renewed after 18-year-old gunman Salvador Ramos opened fire inside Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, killing 19 students and two teachers last Tuesday. Adam Kinzinger, an Illinois Republican, criticized his own party's response to the mass shooting during an interview on CNN. He slammed Republicans who have instead sought to blame the country's mass shooting epidemic on mental health and have suggested efforts to harden schools to prevent shooters from gaining entry. What you're seeing right now is all these politicians that are scared to death to talk about the gun issue. They know that this is an issue, but they're scared to talk about it, so they launch into this thing about mental health, he said. The congressman explained that while he sees mental health is a problem, he highly doubts the politicians using it to evade gun control have funded mental health care. Adam Kinzinger also knocked proposals to introduce other